As Jacob mentioned, this is the first of four Sundays where we are going to be hearing the book of Job. So I'd like to take this opportunity to dive into that book with you for a while. And as we enter into it, I want to suggest that this book asks us to struggle with some of the most important questions that we have as human beings. Why do bad things happen to good people? What's a righteous person? How, if somebody is suffering, how is it best to be with them? How do we respond when we suffer? What does wealth signify? All these and more are woven into the book of Job, which is yet another place in the Bible where there is truly great literature. Through the book of Genesis, 1 and 2 Samuel, many of the Psalms are simply great literature to be ranked with Dante and Shakespeare and Milton. It's that good. The book of Job is one of those. It's also, I want you to bear in mind, often clumped with wisdom literature. That's to distinguish it from those books that are about the law, the books that are about the prophets, or that weave prophetic insight into history. There's another category, wisdom literature, that includes things like Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. So Job deliberately asks us to become wise through wrestling with these deep issues. The other thing I want you to bear in mind about Job is that it has a lot to do with the specifically Christian good news. That the Old Testament, of course, or the New Testament, I should say, is impossible to understand without the Old Testament. The Old Testament gives us the keys to understand what happened and who Jesus was. Job is one of those places that gives insight that we get nowhere else with such clarity about who Jesus was and why he suffered. I had the stunning experience in seminary of having one of the great Old Testament minds of the previous generation, Brevard Childs, who created a whole way of criticism called canonical criticism. At the end of our several sessions of Job, he read aloud a passage from Job, or that could have been from Job, subtly replacing Jesus with Job. And it was amazing how profound the connections were. So if we want to understand Jesus, it's important to understand Job. Now I want to start off with a bit of a guided tour of Job to give you a sense of the lay of the land. So and by all means, please do grab your pew Bibles. We're on page 392. We're on page 392, and then right away, as you find page 392, I would ask you to also put a finger at the very end of the book of Job, which can be found on page 324. So put a finger in 392 and a finger on page 424. 392, 424. So what I want to point out is when you're on page 392, you'll notice that chapters 1 and 2 of Job are in the form of prose, and then in chapter 3, it turns into poetry. Now, if you flip to the very end, you'll notice the opposite. On page 424, you'll notice chapter 42 begins with poetry and then returns to prose. Now, here's the thing I want you to picture, is that one could very easily insert two paragraphs between the end of chapter 2 and then to chapter 42, and you'd have a complete story. You'd have a narrative that seems ancient and right. So in the beginning, we have the story of the person of Job, who's wealthy. You heard Jacob read it, and all of that is taken away. And why is that? Well, you could insert a couple of paragraphs about the friends coming and listening to him while he's suffering, a couple of other people coming, him being spoken to and reassured by God. And now, oops, spoiler alert, if you go to chapter 42, verse 10, what happens? And the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends, and the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. So it could be a very simple parable about what's going on. But of course, that's not what happens in this great piece of literature. Instead, if you want to just flip pages quickly, you'll see it's page after page of poetry. And what happens in that page after page of poetry is that Job has three of his good buddies, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, who come and sit with him and try and, you know, test various explanations for why he's suffering the way that he is. And it's this conversation in poetry about the meaning of suffering. But things take a shift. If you'll flip all the way to chapter 32, which you can find on page 415. Most of the way through the book of Job, another character enters in. It's a young whippersnapper named Elihu, who thinks he's got all the answers. So he comes and gives his explanation, which actually, if you're reading it, in some ways makes the most sense of any of them. It sounds like he's got some pretty good ideas. But Job doesn't even take that. So finally, on page 420, chapter 38, the big boss comes. The Lord answers Job, it says. And in verse 4, God, speaking directly to Job, says, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding." And there proceeds an incredibly powerful speech and response of God. So there you have it. Sorry if I ruined the plot for you. But I want you to bear in mind the whole thing as we slowly walk through it. Because understanding what's going on means bearing in mind all of this. Now, don't put your Bibles away yet. I'd love you to flip back to the very beginning on page 392. And I want to walk you through what we heard this morning. Again, bearing in mind that this is going to be taking us on a path of wisdom. So the passage that Jacob read begins with chapter 1, verse 1. Now listen to this, and as I read it, I want you to ask yourself, what kind of a story do these words and phrases remind me of? "There was once a man in the land of Uz, whose name was Job." Does that sound like a genre you heard when you were a child? "Once upon a time, in a kingdom far, far away, there was a beautiful woman by the name of whatever." It's almost like we're entering into a fable right away, and the way that it's presented gives us that sense. In fact, there's some sort of cues that Job was intended to be rooted in the patriarchal time, the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But there are further cues that this story, although it might have emerged from that time in some way, was crafted and refined much later, very, very deliberately, as a piece of wisdom literature. All right, we skipped chapter 1 in the reading this morning, but that was the first time that we go right from a portrait of how wealthy and successful. And, Job is somebody who has wealth, he has land, he has many kids, he's as great and as happy, as good as it's possible to be. And we get the Council of Heaven round one, which we didn't hear about today. But Council of Heaven round one begins Satan's, the adversary's, saying to God, "Well, of course he loves you. Look at all the stuff you've given to him. It's easy, right? Of course he's going to give you thanks. But take that all away, he's going to curse you." And so God accepts that challenge. And very dramatically takes all of his children, takes all of his wealth, takes all of his land. And what is Job's response? Job's response at the end of chapter 1 is very beautifully put. In verse 21, Job says, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Now, if there's any phrase from this beginning part I would ask you to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest, it's that great phrase. "The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." I will tell you, one of the most significant spiritual moments of my life came with that phrase. When I was working on the staff of Christ Church Cathedral in Hartford, Connecticut, it was a really lovely couple, John and Jill Bien, who were the sextons, that is, that they were the ones who took care of the campus. And they were West Indian, they were from Barbados originally, as were their families. Little known fact, most cigars that we smoke in America that were produced, where the tobacco is predominantly from Central America, the wrappings come from just north of Hartford, Connecticut, where there are tobacco fields. And for generations, West Indians have come up and worked those tobacco fields. And for that reason, there's a very significant West Indian population in Hartford. And of course, West Indians are from the, you know, what were the colonies, so many of them are Anglican. And that's why John and Jill Bien found home at Christ Church Cathedral. John and Jill Bien were not affluent, and I forget what it was, but they suffered some great loss, a family member, some ill fortune happened to them. And I heard about this, and I went to John and said, John, I'm so sorry that this happened to you. And he looked at me with great calm and assurance, with a little bit of a tear in his eye, but with great strength and maturity, and said, the Lord gives, and the Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away, because he knew it in that old language, blessed be the name of the Lord. And I thought to myself, there is a mature Christian man who loves God. So please do take those words into you. So that happened. And then Satan comes back and says, well, you know what? Okay, that's fine, but his body's in great shape. You know, make him suffer physically, and then we'll see what happens with Job. And that's today's passage. So it's another round. Now, one thing I want to slow down and talk about is this Satan figure. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and inflicted loathsome sores on Job from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Job took a potsherd with which to scrape himself and sat among the ashes. Now, what do we make of this Satan figure? Is Satan a real figure? Is that just a sort of figment of our imagination, or does that have some reality for us? I am less certain than I used to be. One of the things that I've been carrying around with me is a beautiful alliteration from the time of Chaucer, where they understood that there were three things that assaulted every human being: the foul fiend, the false world, and the frail flesh. And if I think of it in those terms, there is much that I can account for that's wrong or ill in the world because of our frail flesh, that the spirit is willing but the flesh is weak. I get that. There is much that I can point to in the world that is just plain false, where we understand things incorrectly, and much of the brokenness and suffering that we experience can be chalked up to that. And yet, is there something more? Is there a malign spiritual force out there that rebels against the ways of God in ways that cannot be traced, that cannot be chalked up to sociology or science and the rest of it? I do not know. But I wonder. I have become one who just wonders and wishes to be alert to a dark spiritual force, to the foul fiend, to what in this book is called Satan, the adversary. Next, we go to a very understandable reaction from the spouse. And this is the first of many reactions that are very understandable. And we could probably find ourselves saying something similar, and if we're honest with our own memories, have maybe said something similar once upon a time. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still persist in your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as any foolish person would speak. Shall we receive the good at the hand of God and not receive the bad?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now here's the point that I want you to take away today, the point of this. The spouse is surfacing something that we, in all likelihood, have said. And we are going to find that again and again as we work through this book of Job. The book of Job is saying things we've had in our hearts when we have faced suffering. And if we're honest with ourselves, we've been there, we've said that. Even as we're critiquing, perhaps, what's being said to Job, or critiquing what Job himself has said. The function of the book of Job is to surface those things that are already in our hearts when we wrestle with these questions around suffering and why bad things happen to good people and why bad things happen to us. We've been there. And part of the reason we take this literature seriously is to be honest about that. I told you before, I think, about my exchange with my person in my 20s, 30s group in Los Angeles who was already a great poet and became an even better one. I occasionally see her poems in the New Yorker Poetry Magazine. Her books are published and have been reviewed by the New York Times Review of Books. She's been very successful. She also grew up in a very pious household and had a very rich life of prayer. And I was teaching on prayer and she was troubled, and so asked me to go out for coffee. And so we went for coffee and we were talking about the experience of prayer, and I was telling her about the Psalms. And I said, you know, if you read the Psalms, everything that you can think of before God is expressed there and allows you to say the same thing. And she all of a sudden stood up and she said, oh, when I pray, I edit. And that was so human and real. We do that, right? When we talk to God, we edit out the ugly bits, the judgmental bits, as though those aren't in us. But they are. Who do we think we're fooling? God knows our thoughts. It is good and healthy to understand that those negative things are part, those questions, those strugglings, those anger, those emotions are all part of our relationship with God. And as we read through the book of Job, we're invited to bring those to the surface, realize that those too are our voices, and offer them to God. So right now, we have descended. We have gone down into the book of Job, where we will remain for the next few weeks. Know, as we enter into this journey, that God is coming. Know that Jesus takes even this, fulfills it, suffers through it, and transforms it on the cross and the resurrection. Know that we are going into a dark place, but it is a place of great wisdom. Let us face into this dark place and allow God to transform our tough reality and our tough questions. God can handle it. Amen.